Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Non-Intuitive Bits, episode 32. I am your co-host for today, Zane Rizvi. And yay! With me is our new first-time host, Yun Lu. Yun, take
hello.
It from here.
Nice to meet you. I'm the new host. Yeah. I've been here for a few episodes. Now I'm promoted.
The fastest promotion you'll ever get.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, okay. Then let's get started with some of our topics today. So let's see what we have. The first thing I want to, the first news I want to talk about is actually two IPOs we saw in the past 2 weeks. So we know Snowflake, one is Snowflake, another one is Palantir. Actually, these two, big startup companies actually filed for IPO in the past 2 weeks. So there are 2 points actually I want to mention about these two IPOs. One is Snowflake, which is a kind of a cloud provider startup, which is very popular in recent years. Like we have Databricks, we have Confluence, we have Snowflake, right? One working storage, working machine learning workspace, working the PubSub messaging queues, right? So it looks like in the recent years, this kind of startup become like really, really popular compared to, let's say, 5 years ago. What we saw was social networking or Uber, Lyft, and all those consumer apps. But those startups actually disappeared in recent years. In recent years, all the big ones are the enterprise ones, and in mostly in the cloud business. So this seems like
sorry to cut you off. Just what's Snowflake? I haven't heard of this before.
Oh, it's actually a cross-platform storage provider. They have a very good storage plan, both for I think it's more for data lake kind of application. So other people whoever doing big data processing can just put the data there, and you can choose like Azure, GCP, or AWS. You can choose what's the backend infrastructure you use, and they will index your data for you. They will process your data for you, and then they guarantee their performance is better than the infrastructure under Google. So they actually file for this. Their valuation right now is like 20 billion, actually. And two years ago, when the first time when I heard of them, it was 2 billion. Actually, when I heard them, they just tripled from their previous year, which is 600 million. So it grows really, really fast.
By the way, I want to propose introduction of new currency. So 1 billion is one Instagram, because Instagram was sold with 1 billion. So effectively, they used to call it, they used to cost 1 to 2 Instagrams. Now they cost 2 Instagrams. Okay, sorry. Please proceed.
What's your take on this? Like the shift of kind of tech startups from the consumer to the enterprise and the cloud side, which actually aligns with I feel aligns with the industry change, because in the past, let's say past 3-4 years, and also in the near future years, I say the tech industry is especially the IT tech industry is more about cloud than the consumer apps.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting cycle that you're pointing out, like shifting from like consumer to business and enterprise oriented stuff. I'm a little bit of wondering if this is a cycle that's happened in the past, where you knew, where if you go through like a few decades going back, if the shifts happens, like it's like a cyclical thing that's happening. I don't know the answer to that.
But let me try and understand the premises of the question. So what the question, being enterprise oriented, that's this main company now having?
Let's say, if we go back 10 years, probably we say some apps like 10, 15 years. Right? We say web apps like Facebook. We say with even YouTube, right? This kind of web app. And then in the past, is it 10 years, 5 years, we see like Uber, Lyft, and all those mobile apps, right? And now it seems like the IPOs, like the bigger tech IPOs we had, are all enterprise and cloud-based, like in the recent years.
Let's see. Yeah, I think this has a very interesting explanation under the hood. It's just cost to switch. So it's naturally that the first the industry of IPO penetrated the user base that has low cost for switching, like social network is a good example. And back then, it would be hard, for example, the company that has a long-term investment to be integrated with, let's say, Microsoft technology, suddenly shift on something from away from Windows. Today, we experiencing a situation when more and more big enterprises easily can migrate from one provider to another. The whole multi-cloud movement with Kubernetes is about that. So I can just walk away if I don't like something. And as a result, more and more new IPOs and big companies that penetrate this market because cost of switch is now low for enterprises. It's quite cool observation. I never thought about it until you actually mentioned. But yes, it's. Anyway, sorry. Yes.
So what do you foresee like in the near future? Like in the let's say in the next five years, do you see this trend continuing in the cloud business, or you think there will be some new, let's say, consumer things come? To be honest, I haven't seen a very big consumer tech company, the startup consumer tech company for a long time. Actually, the previous ones maybe we saw IPO is Spotify, but they actually emerged a long time back.
Yeah, there was Snapchat like a couple years ago.
That's like 2016, right?
Snapchat, and that far back.
They IPO'd in 2016, and I believe they probably started in, I don't know, like 2012, probably. That's the kind of trend I observe. You guys, if you have some different opinions, you can talk about it. Yeah.
Oh, to be fair, this trend indeed originated. I've seen this 5 years ago, probably in one of the podcasts we were discussing a similar topic about the fact that current wave of VCs, they no longer funding something that can become successful. They started half a decade ago asking the question, how are you going to make money? This is no longer Wild West where internet is not regulated. There is more and more laws applied to the internet, so it's no longer granted that if you have tons of the personal data, you will be able to convert it to money. It's no longer there, but it used to be. So before there was funding left and right, anything that can be substantially successful. Today, the venture capitalists do ask the question, how we plan to make money, and this results in less funding and less startups.
And startups coming from China instead. TikTok.
TikTok.
Yeah. Oh, TikTok. Yeah, TikTok is huge, actually. What I say? Yeah. I think what I say is the potential market of the mobile side is already like there are too many apps in there already. Like now, if you want to make a success out of it, it's probably really hard. And on the other side, at the cloud business side, I mean, the cloud providers gets really good in the past 5 years, and then you see this flow of a new startup like Snowflake, Databricks. They're all based on cloud provider, and they build some enterprise grade solution which is really good, and the companies like, and now feels like it's maybe from this year and in the next 2-3 years maybe all these companies will go to IPO. And it seems like before I thought this enterprise business, their valuation won't go that high, but now it looks like they can grow really big actually.
So you effectively saying the company that's second level building deeply integrated in cloud products and they going the APOs. I do see indeed that this happening, but it feels so risky. It feels so risky.
Yes, in a way. It feels like the AWS can always like grow to a higher level and try to destroy their business. Right? This also is a kind of a surprise to me actually because like a few years ago when I look at Snowflake, at that time they grew really fast, but what we feel is like AWS will move up, right? move up the stack and try to cover what they do. But now they actually 2 years later they actually 10 times bigger than before. So that's actually surprised me. Yeah. So
somebody is kind of offering multi-cloud as one of their biggest selling points, then that, by definition, it's very hard for AWS to offer them that. And the two runner-ups after AWS, the Azure and GCP, will be happy to say, hey, look, we'll make it easier to support multi-cloud because that's their way to combat AWS's dominance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this actually brings up another point that I want to make about these two IPOs. Actually, I haven't mentioned the talk about the other one, which is Palantir. This company founded in year 2000. So it was like 20 years ago. Was it 2000 or 2002? Yeah, doesn't matter. But it's a long time ago. And on the other hand, Snowflake, probably they founded a little longer ago. Maybe compared to like the 3 years I mentioned, they really grow really fast. Maybe they founded like 6 years 6 years ago. But when you choose to as a tech worker, when you choose to join a startup, like what's the factors you will consider? Instead of choosing a 20-year startup, you probably want to choose Snowflake, right? Because it grows faster and it goes IPO faster.
Yeah, Palantir, I just looked it up. Palantir started in 2003. So it was like post 9/11 that it got its surveillance-based start.
Yes.
And out of other companies, it varies, but with Palantir, that's like the one company which I will never work for, just because it is such a heavily government surveillance Orwellian based company. So just from like a moral perspective, like I could not work there at all. Like they reached out to me once, like a few years ago, and that was just like a hard no right there. Well, once I looked up what they did,
you know, this remind me on this question, which company to join. I think it's Eric Schmidt, right, who started a new company, left Google and started a company that specifically focused on working with the government, because IT company very cautious. So he trying to get that niche. I was about to suggest go work there, everyone. Like, this might be the next big thing, especially that everyone in the industry going away from some of the government contracts, like having the first big IT company that publicly stating no, we're pro-government, might actually be the next unicorn. If you want to earn part of the one Instagram, sure.
That's how the computing industry got its kickstart in the beginning of World War II time frame. They were all getting government funding to develop computers to help with the World War II effort.
Yeah. So to me, I feel choosing a startup is actually very kind of risky decision. Like if 2-3 startups give you offer, and you try to evaluate like 5 years ago, compare Palantir with Snowflake, you actually don't know. Like to me, it's probably I would I may choose Palantir because at that time they were like very hot company. Actually, when I graduated, I still remember when they come to my school, the line was really really long because at that time their valuation at that time was already, I believe, like 20 billion. and then working for like, this kind of big and hot startup was a thing at that time. So all the people actually stand in their line, try to submit resume. So at that time, like if you talk about Snowflake, it was nobody, right? So if you fast the clock to now, then your outcome of joining Snowflake is actually will be much, much better than joining Palantir at that time, because Palantir was still losing money last year. So, and now they filed for IPO, their valuation didn't, they didn't grow a bit compared to like 5 years ago.
So let me ask you this. Are you suggesting that if you're joining the company, you need to join a company that will be successful? Yes, sure.
I think my point is probably the bigger trend is more important. It's like if I am going to choose a startup to join in the in the coming years, I probably will try more to observe the industry trend than actually looking at those whether it's already a successful company, right? Because that's really hard to judge. That's what I feel.
Okay. To be fair, I think one of the interesting comments that pops in my mind, I probably would join industries. So if I would be choosing right now, I will try to find industry that is hardest to disrupt. One something that's really hard and or disruption takes like 10, 20 years, like something among semiconductors. So then if I see a disruption, I will be prepared. Like I have 10 years that I can find another place to work.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like if it depends on what your goals are when you're joining a startup. If your goal is to make a lot of money, the startup's probably the wrong place to join. Especially if it's still like legitimately a startup. If your goal is to learn, then you kind of like look around and say, hey, where do I think I'm going to learn the most interesting set of skills that I want? Because I mean, if you're trying to judge which startup is going to succeed, the VCs who are investing in those startups know way more than you. So by default, you just have to go for the ones who have the biggest valuations, which is almost not a startup anymore at that point.
To be fair, just for the money, better not to bet your career, but to go to a place where you can earn money and invest. Because by design, you can invest in more than one startup. And I would guess that each of us has more than one startup that we subjectively believe will be very successful. Here you go.
Right. And that's very good point. Okay, let's move to our second news, please. So we saw this news that it says Linux server right now.
One thing I just wanted to call out before we move on.
Okay.
And part of me is like very, very surprised that they're going to IPO right now. Just because of all the COVID stuff that's still going on, they didn't feel like they needed to wait for everything to settle down. Maybe like wait for a whole year to pass before filing for IPO.
Yeah, I feel that's also very, very interesting. Actually, maybe they say the recent stock market is really good or something. They observe in Wall Street like to spend money. I don't know.
maybe they're thinking, hey, Wall Street has no other place to spend money right now, so they'll only spend it on us.
Okay. I don't know.
Sorry, go ahead.
I don't know if they already regret like when they saw this week's stock market, right?
I have an alternative theory. Have you folks watched the Wolf from the Wall Street? I think that was
the Wolf on Wall Street.
Yes.
Yeah.
So one of the parts in the movie, they shows how they're doing IPO. and they have many wrongdoing in their docs. So they wanted to do everything they can to steer them away from that. And one of the hacks that they done when committee that checks their papers, their books come in, they switched off IC. So it was really hot, but there is no wrongdoing here. And if you want to see it, sure. So I would assume that amount of people who are going to check your IPO books these days during the COVID is slightly reduced. And this is a good time if you have anything questionable to come to IPO.
Okay. That may be the case.
There we go. Now we short them right when they come out.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's officially move to the second news. So now there's a report saying that Linux servers now are receiving actually more hackers than before. So because they become like much, much more popular compared to, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. At that time, Windows was the major, both on the major server, both on the business and the consumer side. Right. So right now, I actually also don't know when this trend started. But since I joined this industry, it seems like, at least at the developer side, Linux is like extremely popular compared to Microsoft. Right. So now it's a good thing and a bad thing, right? So it's since it's getting more popular, so it's getting more hackers also, and they are trying to develop virus to attack Linux. And the Linux was like once a very considered safe operating system. And probably because nobody wanted to hack it. So, right. And now, yes. Yeah, so I don't know if we have an expert here or no. Like, what do you think? Do you think Linux will be safer than Windows, or like fundamentally any difference like in this area?
This was one of my complaints for a very, very long time. Whenever people would say X operating system is more secure than Windows. It wasn't that it was more secure, that like Mac or Linux is more secure than Windows. There's just way more profit to be had by trying to exploit Windows, so that's where all the effort would be put. Now that the shift is, like the usage seems to be shifting a bit, the attack surface is also shifting the same way, just that one. Even earlier on, like as Macs or iPhones started becoming more popular, people started discovering, oh, here's an exploit for iPhone, here's another exploit for the iPhone. People were using these exploits to jailbreak the iPhone. And like at one extreme, like the biggest exploit I remember was like back when the iPhone 3GS was around, that era. All you had to do to root your iPhone was to visit a website. And that website, just JavaScript or whatever running on that site, was enough to root your phone. And that's how like vulnerable those things were.
Yep, I completely want to second what Zane just mentioned. It's a matter of perception. However, let me say this. Windows and macOS had tons of the security vulnerabilities that got originated because they had a tough deadline that they had to meet. Linux doesn't have, at least in many cases, that problem. I just cannot imagine that Linux, I mean, he's no longer in that much involved as he used to be, but still he's involved. And I just cannot imagine Linus would say, no, we have a bigger event tomorrow by when we need to enable these APIs. So I'm going to merge this PR and we will review it tomorrow, right? No, that's just not possible. But obviously, I'm just joking. Of course, majority of the vulnerabilities is just because people are looking, so they're finding.
So the one thing that is kind of interesting about this article is that it's talking about advanced persistent threats. I haven't heard this term before, but it's where an intruder, and it's usually a nation state or a state-sponsored group, establishes a long-term presence on a network. So just that class of threat is a really interesting one. Where just you've got a nation, just say, hey, look, I'm just going to go squat on Microsoft's network or whichever some other country's network, and I'm just going to stay here and keep monitoring or doing whatever that we want to get done internally.
Oh, so okay. So if I kind of understand this correctly, we now live in the age when there is big companies or maybe governments that are trying to target particular things, and there is some, I don't know, unknown hackers, Russia Limited, somewhere in Urupinsk city in the Eastern Europe, and looks like someone learned that they just start evaluating altogether a particular new operating system. Version of the operating system, and probably they might find soon something new.
There's some interesting stories I've heard of, like how governments have had these kind of persistent hacks into other government stuff. Like there was this one I heard about where the U.S. Like FBI or CIA or whatever, they gave a country an infected printer. They somehow infected some country's printer, like a government printer, and any document that would be printed or sent to that printer, a copy of that document would be sent to the CIA. And that was in place for like ages before it was discovered.
Interesting.
Stuxnet is another example of something like that, where had this flash drive sending in vulnerabilities from one to the other computer to the other until it finally reached the nuclear centrifuges.
I'm trying to recall quickly, I forgot, what was one of the biggest military operations? Storm in where?
Desert Storm?
Yeah, Desert Storm, of course, yes. I'm trying to recall. I think there was a huge thing there of disabling radio equipment because it was produced one of the alliances. I don't remember, but this was quite I wasn't prepared for this topic, but I would try to Google it quickly, but I failed. Yeah, but maybe we'll find by the end of the show, yes.
Yeah. There's another cool thing about just these threats is that there are companies whose whole business model is to find or acquire these different vulnerabilities, and these vulnerabilities like for give a specific operating system or for a specific software, and they'll just stockpile all these, and then they sell those vulnerabilities to governments and other like and potentially other entities, I don't know. And like all the government will do, like US government will say, hey, look, company, we're targeting a computer that's running Windows 7 with Office 2012 or whatever, exactly like say exactly what that computer is running. And this company will just say, okay, here's a bunch of vulnerabilities that you can use to attack that system. And so they're effectively like, have this stockpile of all these vulnerabilities, and they just sell them exactly the vulnerabilities that are needed, and it's a whole business that goes on out of this.
I don't know if that's a one-time sale or it requires you to do a subscription.
I'm sure they've got some way to make sure their pockets stay well padded.
Yeah, if you give the vulnerability out, the buyer may leak it and resell it, right? So maybe you need some mechanism to protect your vulnerability.
Yeah, maybe that's why they only sell to governments. They're like, hey, government's not going to leak it. Well, kind of, because like when the Stuxnet virus, that was like considered to be like a nuclear bomb of viruses, where there's like hundreds of different vulnerabilities stuck in there. And so those vulnerabilities probably came from this type of a source. So after they've infected the computer, those vulnerabilities are all out in the open. And all these researchers like dissected it, took it apart, and they found all the vulnerabilities that were in there, and then they got patched up very soon afterwards. But that was that kind of a company is probably where those vulnerabilities, like the huge stockpile of vulnerabilities, originated from.
Yeah, this is, by the way, I always looking at the Apple that's in many, many cases trying to convince government that there should be no backdoors. Because as soon as you have a backdoor, very likely people whom you intend to use that backdoor will move away. And other people whom you don't intend to know about this backdoor will learn about this backdoor, and here you go. And this is just life.
Right. Like, I mean, is there only going to be one? Is there any country which isn't spied upon by any other country?
Yeah, but as of I understand, Linux is let's say the open source Linux is an open source operating system, right? So which means everybody can actually look at the source code. Does that make it safer than other things, or it doesn't?
Remember Heartbleed or something?
Heartbleed.
With SSL. How can you prove that this was a bug and not a backdoor? Yeah, it's open source. So what? Like, is someone changed that code, and it could be intentional backdoor. But yes, it was open. Everyone saw it.
It just means there won't be a variable labeled backdoor.
And usual backdoors, they're not labeled backdoor. That might be actually a bug that someone found how to exploit. But I'm pretty sure many what they call backdoor is just the bugs that they found, have not told anyone, and start using, but not the intentionally created one.
Okay, that's a good point. By the way, you guys know that Linus recently joined Microsoft. You know that?
He did.
Wait, what?
Linus joined Microsoft as a fellow a few months ago. I remember I saw the news. Actually, it's not in our news topic today, but I remember.
This is a great news topic.
From that article, I vaguely remember Microsoft said they are going to merge Windows with Linux. That's why Linus decided to join them.
Wow.
I say you guys are shocked.
Wait. Wait.
Is that fake news? Or?
Well,
I mean, you guys...
Well, I'm looking it up now, and I'm seeing articles from like 2016 and 2018 with that same title.
Okay, maybe I saw some fake news. Okay. let me come.
This Microsoft.
May have been the Windows subsystem that somebody kind of extended that into a more wishful thinking topic.
Oh, wait, the first Linus Torvalds joined Microsoft is from 1st April 2016. But yet again, maybe there is news. Anyway, man.
Okay, let's continue with our topic today.
I mean, that is our show. We're providing subjective news. So yes, you don't think if we're quoting fake news, that's fine. That's us.
we do the fact checking for you as well.
Okay, next news. So the next topic I want to talk about is actually, I think we already work remotely for, let's say, half a year. And this thing is actually start changing the tech hubs, right? So the real estate and people move out from San Francisco, right? And the rent is dropping and all that. So if the workforce is changing, the way people think is changing. So what do you folks like envision in the future? And let's say Google said they will let employees work until at least July 2021, right? So, and that's at least. So Facebook said they will allow their employees to work remotely permanently. And so do you think this will be a trend in the future? Will the whole industry change because of this pandemic?
Did Facebook allow permanently work from home, really?
I think they said something like that, but
I think that's true. That one I can confirm.
Interesting. To be honest, I wasn't believing that this might happen. And for example, recently Amazon announced quite different trend. They reinvesting, doubling down on investment from office spaces. Maybe
buying office space from Facebook. But yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
I know Google purchased some land in San Jose and tried to build a fresh new campus. So it seems like even from the higher level leadership, they also have different thinking in this topic.
Yeah, it's kind of there's pros and cons. Like on the pro side, tech companies will really reduce their cost of hiring people because they'll be able to hire people at places that cost a lot less. And so if they can really embrace remote working, then it'll reduce their costs. Like even just salaries, they generally don't pay as much salaries if you're outside of these more and more expensive cities. But it also has a cost, because when you're working in person with someone, then you tend to have much higher bandwidth, and it's much easier to have these to communicate and have ideas flow and exchange. Clearly there are companies who have managed it. There are companies which are fully remote and have been fully remote for a long time, and of course we're all fully remote nowadays. But it's a question of like, hey, can everyone thrive in those kind of environments? And if not, then there will be a demand for people who would prefer to work in office locations, and companies who will embrace that will have an advantage in getting those types of people at least.
To be fair,
one comment about what Dane you just mentioned, money-wise it's not going to work exactly like this. Facebook already told that they're going to prorate your salary based on the geographical location from where you remotely work. So it's
right. I mean, that's what I was saying, that like that's how they save money if you move to a cheaper city.
Oh, but you're not going to save because your salary will go down.
I mean, Facebook is going to save.
Ah, Facebook, sure, yes.
As the employee, you don't save. Facebook saves.
But this is then opens question why you want to move. Like first, I thought, yeah, I'm going to move now somewhere like 5 hours from now and live there with my salary. When I learned that prorate happens, I do understand my company doing so, but this means that I no longer have incentivized to go.
Well, it depends, right? Because like if somebody is like mostly, it depends on what's pulling people to a different city. Because there are a lot of people who have families in smaller towns or families outside of the main tech cities. And so before remote work became a norm, they would like working at a successful company was next to impossible from their hometowns. They were much more willing to move to those other cities. But once it suddenly is possible to work remotely and have, they may be willing to take like a relatively significant pay cut, justify to themselves that, hey, it's not that cheap because I'm paying less for housing now. And maybe overall they might find themselves to have better lives, potentially speaking.
What I find is, I mean, for us, we used to, like, we moved to a different city to, let's say, in order to have a good job, let's say, at Google, at Microsoft, at other tech companies. And let's say in the future, which is not the norm, the new norm is, okay, you can work anywhere. I think like for, let's say, more recent college graduates, maybe they will prefer, let's say, stay with their family, and then they can still work for Google. They can still work for these big tech companies. I think even you pay them less, maybe they will accept it.
That's a good point. That like it's not necessarily the people who are already living in places like the Bay Area who would move to somewhere else. But it's the new people who they would be hiring who, like, they don't feel like they're giving up anything by not leaving their hometown. they'll just say, "Hey, yes, I'll take it. I like, because they're not facing any loss aversion because they're not giving up the salary, and they don't have to face the loss aversion of leaving their friends and family and to move to a new city. So, yeah. New employees might be easier to get."
To be fair, I listening to you folks and feel strange, because in my mind, in almost all the cases, you're moving because you want more money. You cannot find the work with the same level of money here. It's not that. Let me put it this way: if I would be a location city A, and suddenly Microsoft will open the world. Oh yeah, actually, good. Have a good example. Samsung gonna open an office in Ukraine. I still left Ukraine because Samsung was paying same salary that pays in Ukraine an average pays to engineer, which was not exactly comfortable for me. And it's nothing to do with the Samsung. It was a big company, and I was doing things that I was like to do. And yeah, still.
Yep. So, Slavoj, what if they, let's say, they can pay, let's say, double the average money in Ukraine than the local, let's say, than the local average pay, right? So, I mean, maybe they do the same in Bay Area. They pay double the average of local pay. But I mean, yeah, of course, like it's smaller amount of money in. I mean, if you compare Bay Area with Ukraine pay. But would you accept that?
So it's actually not... I want to say that it's actually not exactly possible. And there is an interesting reason why it's not exactly possible. If you're the big company, so let's assume you're Microsoft. And it's very common complaint from people that, oh, I have Microsoft in my city, but Microsoft still pays just slightly more than average, slightly. And everyone complains that this is not enough, but no one actually see the interesting trend. As soon as Microsoft says, we will give you 20% more, the market will follow. Because small companies around Microsoft, they cannot afford not to match what Microsoft pays. So it's impossible to double, because if you will double, the market will double. And what can follow, you can either will start killing players around, in which point local law enforcement will interfere and start questioning if you're using money that they earned elsewhere to kill competitors in this geographical location, or you kind of have to play by the rules of the market. And here is where other differentiation factors starts plays in. We have a better office, we have a better equities, we have a better other, because you literally cannot double because the market will just double. Now you're just paying more, but you still don't have an advantage. Maybe for a short period of time, if I'm going to double salary starting today, it will take market a quarter to react, but it will react.
I mean, I don't know if I buy that argument, because I mean, unless you have like you've seen strong evidence that that is what happens, because. Like, if you go to any city where Microsoft might want to open an office, presumably Microsoft's not the only company who would want to open an office. It'll be like all the other big tech companies will probably be eyeing it as like a potential office spot as well. And Microsoft is opening the office partially because it's just trying to get additional talent at a lower cost. I mean, they could get additional talent even over here in San Francisco if they were willing to pay a higher cost, but they're specifically trying to get talent at a lower cost. That's why they're going to those other locations. And each company tends to have a percentile of this market. Like if an engineer at a specific level earns a certain range of income, each company tends to have like a specific percentile that they're trying to target. Like Microsoft, like I don't know the actual number, but Microsoft might be trying to target that it's better than 70% of the companies who are available. And another company might be trying to say be better than 90% of the companies that offer salaries. So they're all kind of have their predefined spot in the like in that range that they want to sit on. And that is kind of like what they consider to be their strategic location. And if they raise their rates, they know that the people they're competing for folks against will also raise their rates to a certain extent. I mean, to a certain extent, all these companies got in trouble back in, what was it, 2010 or something, for colluding to bring prices down. So that kind of stuff is definitely, it happens as well. So I don't know if like local regulations would be as much of a factor, because like it's, that would only like even come into play if Microsoft would want to hire 20% of all engineers in an area, even, which is probably way more than what Microsoft would be able to willing to even just staff a company at in a smaller city.
Okay, I think I heard arguments from both sides. So seems like we have supporters at both sides, like working at a smaller city for a bigger company and working at a bigger city. What I feel it's it may go both directions actually. Like let's say in the next year we get a vaccine and everybody's safe to go out and go to like our normal life again, then I feel it can just go back to the original condition, right? Like I'd rather just go to work in the office. But I mean, it may well also a start of a kind of digital revolution. I mean, that's also what the article kind of speculates. So yeah, let's say it's.
Well, one thing that a lot of folks I've been talking to, and I feel the same way, is like if you ask them like, hey, would you like to work remotely full time after this is all over, or would you rather go to the office? A lot of folks have been saying, you know, I'd like to go to the office 2 to 3 days a week and stay home the rest of the week. And that would be like a new ideal thing. Like, oh, I just go to the office on the days where I have to have like meetings, and I'll just like bucket my meetings into like 2 or 3 days. And work from home the rest of the day, or rest of the week. How do you feel?
This part I actually don't know. I kind of still enjoy working at Google site, because I guess Google provides a lot of good things for us, and it's also not that far, let's say, driving from my place to my office. But for people who maybe have longer commute, then they will be in more trouble to get into the office. So maybe they prefer to, let's say, work at home for longer time. But what I feel is in the past half year and the coming, let's say, 1 year, it's kind of like a interesting social experiment. Give both the, let's say, the CEOs, the leadership, and also the employees a way to experiment in this kind of new life.
Right. One interesting dilemma with this showing up for work 2 to 3 days a week method is like you at the first thought you would have like, oh hey, people are only showing up to work 2 to 3 days a week, then the companies will have a lot more capacity available to hire more people and with the same amount of desks. Except everybody will want to show up on the same 2 to 3 days. They're all showing up to meet each other. Everyone will want to stay home on Monday and Friday. And maybe like the middle 3 days of the week is when everybody will want to show up.
Yeah. Actually, what I'm more afraid is, will this, let's say, bigger enterprise give us a chance to choose to work on sites? I even doubt that, because to Zane's point, is actually cost saving wise, it's more beneficial for these companies than us, right? So they can hire people at a lower salary, and they can save the office space cost, right, easily. I don't know how much is that, but also. In some like smaller place, maybe they also pay less tax. So I feel maybe Wall Street will drive these companies to enforce work from home. That's what I'm kind of speculating.
It's a possibility. One thing that is kind of interesting right now with all these different companies trying different things, we're kind of recreating the old city-states that used to be. Because, for example, like back in Rome is like the famous example, and really the most of the world was like this, but back in Rome, you had all these different city-states that were around, and each state, each city, was basically had its own form of government that would run the city in a very different way. Athenians were one way where they were like very democracy-based, like trying to have local democracy going on and whatnot. There were the Spartans who were very military-based, and they had a completely different culture and a completely different set of ways for how they would do things. And all these other cities, they all had different ways of doing things and different customs. And an effect of this was that you're effectively running many different experiments in parallel, and you're figuring out, hey, which of these leads to a more successful city, a more stable civilization. And so by all these tech companies trying different ways to do work from home, work remotely, partial work from home, partial, or force everyone to come into the office, you're kind of like running these experiments at the, in a similar way over here. And then the results will speak for themselves in the long run.
Okay. I think it's... Slava. Oh, we lost Slava?
Slava, yeah. Slava's like internet connection was going bad, and then suddenly he just dropped out. So I think his internet died.
Okay. I think we're also about time for today's episode.
Right. Yeah, that's a good time.
Yeah, so it's actually a good time to end. So thanks for joining us, and bear with me if my hosting still sucks.
I'm a new host.
I'll try to improve every time I be the host. And thank you for coming. Thank you, Zane. And thank you, Slava, although he's not here anymore.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right.
See you guys next week.
See you.